On this episode of Women Behind Bars, one woman allegedly set a fire that killed two sleeping children.
There was flame visible lapping out the front door. Either one, it has been cooking for a long time, or two, it's had some help.
There was some kind of an explosion. And I don't remember nothing after that until I was standing in the neighbor's living room talking to a private detective and a minister.
Then, Linda Pilius tells her story. She pled guilty to stabbing a friend to death.
I guess I never really dealt with my anger that I've encountered from when I was a child.
He would show up here with knife marks, black and blue. He said, yeah, she'll probably end up killing me, ha 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 ha. But I'm the only friend she's got in this world. I can't turn my head on her.
Two women, two brutal crimes. These are the stories of Karen Mullaly and Linda Pilius. On the night of November 3rd, 1985, Karen Mullaly was the only adult present at a house fire that killed two young children.
The oldest child came downstairs and woke me up and said, Karen, there's a fire upstairs.
At first, it appeared accidental, but investigators suspected arson.
There were separate fires that had been started in that house that evening.
This was a circumstantial case, but I thought an overwhelming case against Ms. Mullaly.
I don't believe that she is that person who would do something to harm a child.
Karen's friend and alleged lover, Patty Turo, had left Karen alone with her children.
Her lover showed an interest in another woman, and this sparked an argument.
Was Karen Mullaly a jealous woman seeking revenge, or was she wrongly convicted of arson and murder? Although Karen Mullaly's father left the family when she was very young, her mother soon remarried, providing a happy childhood during her early years.
My mom met this wonderful man, and he moved her 3 weeks after he met her into a four-bedroom house on the south side of the city. My mom and my stepdad was always good to me.
At 9 years old, however, the good times came to an end when a nun at Karen's Catholic school asked her to carry an envelope to the principal's office.
I was all excited, thinking she picked me out of the whole class to do her a favor. And I was whistling and skipping to the principal's office. And when I got there, the principal read the note.
But the note to the principal accused her of destroying a math book.
The principal read the note and told me to put my hands out in front of me. She started beating me with a thick paddle.
Karen did not know what she had done wrong. And as her frustration grew, she fought back.
When I was trying to ask her why she was hitting me, the more she'd hit me. I just flipped and I started hitting her with the paddle.
As a result, Karen was sent to a nearby reform school.
She left home early, so she was basically on her own. She said she was very independent of her family early on.
After 3 years, Karen was terrified that eventually she would be transferred from a reform school to prison. A schoolmate told her one way to be sent home was to stage a suicide attempt.
So I put some belts together. When I hear the house mother come with the dinner and I hear the keys, I'll kick the chair. That way she'll find me in time. I didn't really try to commit suicide that time. That was trying to do that just so I could get out of reform school.
It worked. Karen spent 6 months in an outreach program at a state hospital. She then went home and tried to fit in.
I was good. We lived around a lot of old Italian people, and I used to carry their groceries.
But Karen claims she faced trouble at home as well.
I had a lot of depression because my mother's brother used to abuse me, but I never told nobody. I used to cry, and he'd say, this is a beautiful thing. This is showing you how much I love you, and this is our secret.
There were times, Karen says, when she would have to endure the abuse for months.
When he would come and stay there at my mother's, that's when I would act up and go back to the hospital.
The young teen was in and out of psychiatric care until she was 18. Then, as a high school dropout, she married Dennis Mullaly, whom she had been dating for 3 years.
I felt like I loved him as a person, but I didn't have that shocking, you know, that good feeling about loving somebody.
Weeks later, Karen left him, but they never divorced. Then in 1980, after several relationships and a miscarriage, she met a customer at a bar where she worked as a barmaid.
Before I found out she was a girl, I started catching feelings for her because she used to do really nice things for me. She was an auto mechanic. Every time I seen her, she was in her work clothes, and she looked just like a little guy.
Karen says they had gone out a few times before she realized her friend was a woman.
I noticed she had breasts. I was shocked. I still seen her after that for a while, but then I said, no, this ain't for me.
2 years later, Karen says she became distraught over a relationship with a man she was allegedly living with.
We were having a lot of problems, and he was seeing somebody else. I said, I feel like I'd be better off if I was dead. I turned all the gas on the stove and tried to commit suicide by the gas.
According to court records, the house caught fire.
I woke up sometime later, and I lit a cigarette, and there was an explosion. And I had forgot I turned the gas on. But they came in and got me.
The records also state that Karen was not living with a man, but that her roommate was a woman with whom she was having an affair. Considered a suspect, Karen was not prosecuted for arson. Instead, she spent 2 weeks in Hutchings Psychiatric Center in Syracuse.
She had been involved in the other fires, but had never been arrested.
After the incident, Karen chose not to seek additional counseling, but instead continued drinking and spending her free time in bars.
I drank every day. I didn't know until I came here, but I was an alcoholic. I didn't think I was because I was functional.
By 1985, Karen had struck up a friendship with Patty Turo at the bar they both frequented. Patty was a young mother of two going through a bitter divorce and had started dating women.
We always had good times. Just partying, playing pool. He was on bowling leagues.
But Patty's sister Paula disliked Karen right from the start.
She started dating different girls. She met this Karen, and she was kind of loud, you know, obnoxious, very straightforward. I just didn't like her.
Karen played poker on weekends at the house Patty and her children shared with her mother, sister, and nieces. Her nieces, Paula Jean Drinkwine, who was 8, and her sister Danielle, who was 9, remember Karen well.
We didn't like her when she came there because she was always mean and just really controlling over Patty.
I remember her kind of being mean to Patty. The whole situation was new to us because she was just getting divorced.
Patty's children, Tracy and Polly Turo, were just toddlers when the women met.
They were like our little brother and sister, really, because we all lived together, so they were more than just cousins.
They were beautiful kids.
When Tracy had just started kindergarten, and Polly knew what time she'd be coming down the hill home, and he'd be sitting there waiting for her.
The Drinkwines believe Karen was drawn to Patty because she did not have children of her own.
I had 3 pregnancies, and I lost all my... I had one I lost in my 7th month, one I only carried for 4 months, and my last one I had died at birth.
The two friends would go to gay bars, which was considered taboo at the time.
In 1985, certainly in a mid-sized, fairly conservative city, which Syracuse is, nobody talked openly about same-sex relationships.
The nature of their friendship, which was alleged to be sexual, would become an important part of the case against Karen.
It was kind of a romantic relationship.
But Karen claims that although she thought about having sex with women, she never went that far. She insists her relationship with Patty was platonic.
After she dropped the bombshell on me and told me that she was in love with me, I told her, listen, I'm not gay.
Although they still maintained a friendship, Karen says she pulled away from Patty after hearing about her feelings. But that did not stop Patty, according to Karen.
She kept nagging me and nagging me.
When Women Behind Bars continues.
I feel terrible about those children, and I still do to this day. I still do. But I couldn't get to them. There was nothing I could do.
In 1985, 32-year-old Karen Mullaly struck up a friendship with Patty Turow, a mother of two who had begun dating women after a bitter divorce. For Patty and Karen, it was a typical night out. They'd been drinking throughout the afternoon and were at a bar competing in a pool tournament.
Right after the pool tournament ended, Patty says, "I gotta go to the house and take the babysitter home by 9 o'clock. She said, "Will you ride out there with me?"
Karen, who claims she drank less than Patty, says her friend was too drunk to drive and asked for the car keys.
We got out in the parking lot. She wouldn't give me the keys. But it was really cold outside, so we stood in the parking lot arguing for about 25 minutes.
Eventually, Karen says Patty sobered up enough to drive them to Patty's house in the Syracuse suburb of Baldwinsville. Paula Jean and Danielle Drinkwine were still living with their Aunt Patty and cousins, Tracy and Polly.
We had a babysitter, and she watched us for a few hours, and then my aunt came home with her girlfriend, Karen.
Patty, Karen, the babysitter, and the four children piled into the car to take the babysitter home.
On the way back from taking the babysitter home, the oldest child, she wanted to go to McDonald's.
After her activities over the weekend and drinking all day, Karen was tired.
She wanted to take the kids home first and put the two youngest ones to bed. And she said, "You stay with them." So then I said, "It's late and I just want to go to sleep. You go to McDonald's and I'll go lay down and you can take me on your way to work in the morning."
But the Drinkwines recall a different version of events, one that Karen denies.
We came back home and Karen and my Aunt Patty got into an argument.
Karen was jealous. She was jealous, you know, that Patty was showing interest in somebody else. She had another girl that liked her. Karen was a little bit spitten and jealous of Patty seeing somebody else.
She thought that her lover was paying attention to another woman.
When she would eventually testify, Patty would deny that she ever told Karen about another woman. Patty left Karen and the children at the house and drove to McDonald's. It was between 9:30 and 10 p.m.
Karen made Patty leave to go get her something to eat. I remember that.
I really believed that she was just leaving to go out back out drinking and she wasn't going to McDonald's. And she just wanted that excuse for me to stay there with the kids. I was just exhausted. All I wanted to do really was go to sleep.
Karen says she went downstairs to go to bed in the split-level house. The children were upstairs.
Polly and Tracy came in the room, and they asked if they could sleep with us, and we told them no. And that was the last time we seen them.
Paula Jean and Danielle were playing with a new toy they had gotten that day.
We were playing the game, and I kept hearing a funny noise, like a clicking noise, and we didn't know what it was.
I heard some weird noises, and I thought my sister was doing it, and I asked her to stop.
Danielle yelled at me. She was like, "Cut it out. Stop doing whatever you're doing." I'm like, "I'm not doing anything."
It was like a crackling noise. And so I got up and I seen this huge fire.
Her eyes just opened up and she's like, "There's a fire in the house." And she ran.
Danielle ran to a neighbor's house for help. Paula Jean stayed and called for her cousins through the flames.
I went almost face-to-face with the fire.
Paula Jean thought Tracy and Polly were sleeping in her grandmother's room. The heat quickly spread to that area.
I yelled for them, but they never came.
Unable to find her cousins as the fire spread, Paula Jean ran to get Karen.
I went downstairs and she was lying on the bed in the basement like she was sleeping, and I kind of had to wake her up and say, the house is on fire.
According to Karen, she sent Paula Jean out of the house and then went to rescue Tracy and Polly, who were still inside.
I started to crawl towards the exitway where the doorway was for his grandmother's bedroom.
But the children were not in that room.
There was some kind of an explosion. And I don't remember nothing after that until I was standing in the neighbor's living room talking to a private detective and a minister.
Fire Chief Tom Perkins was suspicious of the fire from the moment he arrived.
We envisioned heavy smoke coming from this house. It was flame visible, lapping out the front door as we were going in, which is an indication that either One, it has been cooking for a long time, or two, it's had some help. Shortly after the arrival inside the house, our first hose line crew came upon the body of one of the children.
Paula Drinkwine and her mother returned home from bingo as the firefighters doused the flames.
I went into my neighbors and said, you know, where's the kids?
Rescue teams found Tracy's lifeless body on a landing. Pauly was in his room. He had been hiding under the bunk bed, clutching a toy.
Patty was, hysterical. They took her and my mother to the hospital.
And we did find a body under a bed on the second floor, and we also found a body at the lower landing on the lower level of the house.
The children died of smoke inhalation.
I love them. I feel terrible about those children, and I still do to this day. I couldn't bring them back. I couldn't get to them. There was nothing I could do.
The next day, investigators continued interviewing witnesses.
Both the children who escaped from the fire, as well as their aunt, their accounts of what happened that night were in contrast to what Karen Mullaly was telling us.
Karen's initial version of events gave investigators cause to be suspicious.
There was a babysitter watching the four children that night. Pat Turrell came home with Karen Mullaly, and it was determined that all the kids would come with Pat and Karen as they took the babysitter home. That is not what Karen Mullaly told us. The children also told us what happened while their aunt was gone to get food, and that contradicted what Karen Mullaly told us.
I told them the truth after. I told them as it came back to me.
We believe that she was not being honest, and that for some reason she was covering up what actually occurred for her own benefit. We had no reason to believe that the children were not being honest with us.
The fire department also had reason to believe that this could be a case of arson.
There were actually at least three different starts. So it was determined that it was suspicious.
William Fitzpatrick was a successful and respected prosecutor, known for an excellent trial record and high conviction rate.
There was some thought that it might have been an accidental fire. My own standard is not just beyond a reasonable doubt, it's beyond any shadow of a doubt. As I sit here right now, I would stake my life on the fact that Karen Mullaly set those fires and killed those two children.
Encouraged by this certainty, officials called on one of the area's top arson investigators.
Arson is an extremely difficult crime to prove because by its very nature, the evidence is consumed. So we employed Dan Stauffer.
I was looking to see, number one, where the fire started and if we could determine the heat source.
Stauffer ruled out a furnace or electrical fire and uncovered a key to the case.
We had more than one area of origin in the house at different levels, and that the only conclusion that could be drawn is that the heat source had to be humanly induced by somebody.
We would never play with matches, we would never set our house on fire, and we would never leave our cousins behind.
Prosecutors did not believe the Drinkwine girls had set the fires, despite their feelings about Karen.
We may have not liked Karen or been scared of her, but we didn't want to hurt her.
The fires were either set by the children or by Miss Mullaly, and I think the overwhelming evidence pointed clearly to Karen Mullaly.
When Women Behind Bars continues.
I should have been able to take the stand in my own behalf. I've never been able to be heard.
And later, Linda Pilius faces murder charges in the stabbing death of a man who gave her a place to live.
Dennis and I were arguing over a piece of crack, and he got violent. So I grabbed a knife and I stabbed him twice.
On the night of November 3rd, 1985, two young children died in a house fire near Syracuse, New York. At first, it appeared to be accidental, but investigators came to suspect 33-year-old Karen Mullaly, the only adult present, of arson. It became a sensational story, making local headlines.
Karen Mullaly had been involved in at least three other fires, which were suspicious in nature. They weren't allowed to be brought into evidence. However, we had uncovered information, and the patterns in those fires were very, very consistent with the fire that had been set that night.
She was a suspect in those fires, and one of them was an incident where she apparently set the fire herself in an effort to kill herself, which is probably what happened here.
Karen Mullaly was never charged for the other incidents, but they were reported in the news before her arrest.
A lot of that information came out and was publicized prior to the trial, which is kind of like setting a jury up to know facts that they really aren't supposed to know, but they know because it's a small community.
Nearly 3 months after the fire, Karen had not consulted an attorney, but knew she was a suspect. Investigators had questioned her and given her lie detector tests, which were inconclusive. Nonetheless, the case against her was building.
I knew they was coming to get me. I said, I'm not going nowhere. So I didn't do nothing, and they can't get away with this.
Karen was arrested and assigned an attorney. The case went before a grand jury to determine if there was enough evidence to go to trial.
This was a circumstantial case, but I thought an overwhelming case against Ms. Mullaly.
Immediately prior to the grand jury presentation, the girls are confronted by the prosecutor of the case, and they are asked whether or not the sound they hear is consistent with the lighter.
Fitzpatrick separated the drink wine girls and asked them about the noises they heard that night.
Tried some different sounds, and when we went to the sound of the Bic lighter, vision being obstructed, both kids independently said, boy, that sounds exactly like what we heard.
Instead of hearing a crackling like wood burning, now they're hearing a lighter. And they're hearing not just a lighter, but a specific number of clicks. And you have to say to yourself, is that really humanly possible, or were these kids somehow coached into saying it?
It's not unusual for a child witness or for any witness to recall some things later on that might be important to an investigation. I was fairly confident that what they were saying was their accurate recollection.
With enough evidence, prosecutors decided to move forward. Karen was charged with 4 counts of second-degree murder and second- and fourth-degree arson. The case went to trial in July.
She's got 2 of the best defense lawyers in Onondaga County representing her.
Well, they were very, very skilled lawyers, both of them, and both very, very good in the courtroom.
The prosecution had a long witness list. Some of the most memorable testimony came from Paula Jean Drinkwine.
It was uncanny. She leaned forward, click, 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 leaned back, and just sat there for a minute. It was just an incredible thing to see a child do under all that pressure.
It was compelling. But Karen says her mother was prepared to testify that weeks before she had taken a lighter from young Polly Turo and gotten into an argument with Patty.
She said, give it back to him. He can play with it. He plays with my lighter all the time. He even lights my cigarettes.
The defense did not call Karen's mother as a witness.
They didn't appear to want to blame the dead children, thinking it may offend somebody, you know, but the facts are the facts. If the facts say there's a likelihood that these kids did it, that's where you gotta go.
The Drinkwine's testimony was important, but prosecutors had another key witness.
The most compelling evidence for me against Karen Mullaly clearly was the separate areas of origin of this arson fire.
There was a fire in this laundry basket, and as the basket began to collapse, the actual flame involvement went straight up, hit the ceiling tiles, had no place to go, and started to move horizontal across the ceiling before it went out.
The critical thing was the fire investigator, and I think that's where it was problematic.
What the defense was trying to show was that might have been a drop down. In other words, there was fire upstairs, and that it might have spread through the floor and dropped down.
I think their strategy was really to poke holes at what the prosecution presented and to simply claim that the charges weren't proved beyond a reasonable doubt.
The defense questioned Stauffer, but rested without calling a single witness.
They should have had an expert come in and say, look, children start fires. They start them all the time. And they aren't able to disprove the fact that in this particular case, the fire wasn't started by these children.
I should have been able to take the stand on my own behalf. I've never been able to be heard.
It took the 10-woman, 2-man jury just over 4 hours to reach the verdict. Karen Mullaly was found guilty of 2 counts of second-degree murder in the deaths of Tracy and Paul Turo, the children of her lover. Mullaly was also found guilty of fourth-degree arson.
They had no evidence whatsoever to convict me of that crime. And then there was a lot of stuff that was done that was not right.
I believe it was the quality testimony that the fire investigator presented at the trial, together with the testimony certainly of the two girls, that led to the jury finding her guilty.
Although it was nice for the jury to have a motive that this woman, you know, had an explosive temper and was angry at her lover, it really could have been proved even without that.
I was innocent. I was devastated. I just couldn't believe it. I've been here 23 years for something I didn't do.
They always say they're innocent, you know? I say, put her in a room and set her on fire and let her try to get out. That's an eye for an eye, right?
Patty Turo and Karen Mullaly are no longer in contact. Patty has never remarried or had any more children.
If you start talking about it, she just goes in the other room or walks away. She can't deal with it. She can't talk about it. She doesn't even look at the photo. She won't look at them. No, she has animals. That's her kid. She has a lot of animals, but that doesn't replace kids.
Karen still denies she was ever Patty's lover. She filed appeals to overturn the case, but they were denied.
She believes she's innocent. In my opinion, the facts kind of support that she's innocent.
At age 57, Karen says she is in poor health.
My worst nightmare is that I'm going to die in prison for something I didn't do.
Karen is eligible for parole in 2 years, which worries the Drinkwine family.
I don't think that she should get out of jail. She destroyed many, many lives forever, and it's for us, it's never going to end. So why should prison end for her?
But after more than 2 decades at Bedford Hills Correctional Facility, her fellow inmates believe Karen has earned parole.
Physically, emotionally, mentally, spiritually, she's paid her dues. She's paid her debt to society, and I just hope that they can forgive her, even if she doesn't forgive herself.
Asserting her innocence, it scares Karen to know that she may never be released.
I've been here 23 years, and it's just not right that I have to suffer like this for something I didn't do.
When Women Behind Bars continues.
I was crazy jealous. I didn't mean it to happen, but I snapped.
For more information about Women Behind Bars, go to WeTV.com. In the early morning hours after Labor Day weekend in 2004, Linda Pilius, a drifter with a history of violence and mental illness, stabbed and killed her friend, Dennis Titus.
I said, Dennis, she's trouble. You better watch out. And he said, oh, I can handle her.
I noticed the big change in Linda the minute you added alcohol to her.
I was crazy. That's why I was on so many meds.
I think she was just very evil, not necessarily insane.
Was Linda Pilius a woman who was overcome by her addictions or a manipulative killer with a chilling violent history?
I was close to my mother. However, I was not close to my father. I was physically abused, mentally, emotionally abused by him. I just never had high self-esteem.
Linda couldn't even stand her father, claimed that he's the one that did everything to her in her past that created her problems.
According to Linda, she was diagnosed with a variety of mental problems as a young teen and was given medications. Her early life was lived in a haze of drugs.
I don't think I ever got to know myself because I was drugged up since 13 years old, 14, that I didn't give myself a chance to grow emotionally or mentally.
As a teenager, she also developed a drinking habit and left home.
It was my whole life, just drinking and drugging and using and going from one place to another, running around the countryside, doing what I could do to survive.
By 1980, Linda was living in San Diego and learned she was pregnant. Before her son Robert was born, the boy's father left Linda.
I thought that he would love me and I would love him forever. I didn't realize the responsibilities of taking care of a child.
According to Linda, she could not care for Robert on her own, so they went back home to live closer to her family in New York. Having a son brought her happiness, but Linda's addictions were strong. She and a boyfriend were out one night when they met a woman at a bar. Linda attempted to rob her, but things quickly got out of hand.
Always carried a knife. They were fighting, and I took the knife out and I stabbed her while being under the influence. I blacked out.
Linda stabbed the woman and beat her with a candlestick. The woman survived.
I guess I never really dealt with my anger that I've encountered from when I was a child.
Her son Robert went to live with an aunt when Linda went to prison for second-degree attempted murder. After serving the minimum sentence, she was released on parole. Looking for a fresh start, Linda moved to Rochester. She wanted to bring her son Robert back into her life.
My sister wouldn't let me have custody of my son, and I was very depressed over that and started drinking again.
Trying to break the cycle, Linda enrolled in an addicts program tailored to her needs. That's where she met Brian Delafrenier. They dated for 8 years.
She was involved in my family holidays. She could cook, clean. She'd do anything to go out of her way to help somebody.
As Brian and Linda faced their addictions together, their bond grew. She was honest with him about her sadistic past.
I knew that she had gotten out of jail for attempted murder. Those were her first charges. But I had no fear of Linda. I never seen that in her.
Between 1991 and 1994, Linda's life began to get on track. She held down jobs at local shops, went to counseling at Rochester Psychiatric Hospital, and even developed a love for animals.
One thing myself and Linda had in common was we had a dog. His name was Max. And that was Linda's life right there, as well as the two lovebirds and the cockatiel that we had.
But staying employed was hard for Linda. She gave in to the pull of her addictions.
I had more self-esteem when I drank and used, and I would feel normal.
The minute Linda started doing street drugs, cocaine, heroin, alcohol, that's when she stopped doing her mental health medications.
I could have stopped, but I didn't want to stop. Even with mental meds, it didn't kill that pain as good as the alcohol and the drugs did.
Brian worked hard to stay sober, but Linda continued to lose control. She became dangerous company to keep.
I loved Linda as much as a person could love her, and then eventually it came to a point where I couldn't. When she attacked me with the knife, at that point I couldn't live with her anymore.
Linda later moved in with Brian's mother and had support when she was diagnosed with a life-threatening form of cancer.
I did full body radiation. It went into remission for only 1 year and then it came back.
She had people that loved her, people that cared for her, people that would do stuff for her, help her out when she was in her difficult times with her having cancer.
Even with his family committed to helping her, Linda abused their trust. By 2002, Brian's family could no longer deal with Linda and told her she had to leave. By 2003, Linda had found her way to Scottsville, a suburb of Rochester, where she met landscape designer and handyman Dennis Titus.
He was just one of those special souls. He said, oh, well, she's dying of cancer and she's really a nice person and I want to help her out.
His friend and neighbor, Nancy Meyer, agreed to give Linda a room in her boarding house as a favor to Dennis.
She appeared to be very, very nice, but just something didn't click with her.
Dennis was a friend and a lover. I loved him very much.
But Dennis's friends and family say it was not a romance.
There was no relationship there. They didn't like each other. At least I know Dennis didn't like her. Maybe she thought the other way, but I don't know.
He never told them we had a relationship. He just told them that he was helping me out.
Linda claims that she and Dennis liked to do drugs together.
He introduced me to crack cocaine. So we started using together. And that's when he started getting abusive towards me.
But people who knew Dennis say he liked to drink, but did not use drugs. They think he was the victim.
He would show up here with knife marks, black and blue. He said, yeah, she'll probably end up killing me, ha 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 ha. But he said, you know, I'm the only friend she's got in this world. I can't turn my head on her.
Nancy says a tenant moved out when Linda threatened to kill her. Nancy later forced Linda out too, and Dennis took her in.
It was a camper, but he made it into like a little trailer. And I moved in with him there, right next to his parents' house.
And he said, well, she's at my place just for a couple nights. And I said, Dennis, she's trouble. You better watch out. And he said, oh, I can handle her.
When Women Behind Bars continues.
She stabbed him. I mean, there's no getting around that. She stabbed Dennis Titus.
For decades, Linda Pilius, a cancer patient, convicted felon, and aggressive drug abuser, struggled to live a normal life. Without a place to live, she had nowhere to go. Landscape designer Dennis Titus took her in for a few months. Then he tried to get her to move out.
I didn't want to leave. And every week he would tell me, get out, get out. He'd kick me out.
As Indian summer waned in upstate New York, Dennis took two family friends, a woman and her stepdaughter, on a boat ride along the river near his house. Instead of joining them, Linda took Dennis's truck into the city of Rochester.
I thought he was cheating on me, and then that made me even more crazier than what I was. I went into the city to cop some drugs, and then coming back, I stopped at the bar to have some drinks.
Linda returned to the mobile home in the early morning hours and had an argument with Dennis.
Dennis and I were arguing over a piece of crack, who would get it. And he got violent, and I was trying to fight him back at first, but I didn't have the energy, so I grabbed a knife and I stabbed him twice.
Linda says she was not only angry about the crack, but also jealous of Dennis's divided attention that day.
I was crazy jealous. I didn't mean it to happen, but I snapped.
Just after he was stabbed, Dennis managed to get to his parents' house next door where his mother called 911. Before he passed out, Dennis told his mother that Linda had stabbed him.
It's a rural area. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. The victim was on the ground and he wasn't able to talk. So we didn't know actually where the stabbing occurred. So we just had to start checking the area for the female. Another 911 call came from the area of 51 Erie Station Road for a female white that was banging on the door.
Edwards was one of the deputies who responded to the call. Employees from a roadside donut shop alerted them that Pilius was inside.
She had dried up blood on her arms and she was just kind of like leaning down into the table with her head down in her arms. She did not say anything. We just directed her to get down on the ground where we took her into custody without any incident.
Linda was taken to a nearby hospital where she was questioned by police.
She was very manipulative from the start of it. She would go in and out of moods. You know, she had to be tied down at the hospital.
And I didn't want to talk. I was so upset.
When investigator Vaughn was eventually able to question her, Linda seemed to be testing her limits.
I think she was trying to achieve to be a victim, to play the victim. And I don't believe she was a victim.
Linda calmed down and provided an oral statement to officers.
She confronted Dennis about what happened with the girls. She asked him if he wanted to have sex with the girls. He said yes, but they didn't want to. So she became mad, and then she said she grabbed a knife and then stabbed him twice in the chest.
When taken to the sheriff's office for further questioning, Linda's story changed in her written statement.
She said that she was telling the truth this time, that this was the actual story.
She said Dennis was angry because she took his truck into town and that Dennis was the one who grabbed the knife. With differing stories, prosecutor Catherine Wagner would have to piece the events together for herself.
Because Dennis Titus and Linda Pilius were the only two people in that trailer when this crime occurred, we'll never know exactly how it happened.
In both accounts, prosecutors had a key to the investigation.
The most beneficial part of the statement is that she stabbed him. I mean, there's no getting around that. She stabbed Dennis Titus.
A few hours after he was admitted to the hospital, Dennis Titus died. The knife used to stab him had cut one of the main arteries in his heart. The crime was now a murder case.
We ended up taking her to the court for arraignment. At the judge's chamber, she became difficult again with the judge and didn't initially want to listen to him.
Linda was immediately arrested and sent to county jail to await trial for Dennis's murder. That same day, prosecutors met with Dennis's parents.
They were very upset that Linda Pilius was painting a very incorrect picture of their son, that he was a batterer of her. That was completely untrue, and they felt very upset about that.
Linda may have led Dennis to think he was her only friend, but investigators talked to people who knew her and uncovered Linda's history of violence.
Linda Pilius was a troublemaker. I don't think he knew how bad. I don't think he knew about her history, or he wouldn't have allowed her to live with him.
It became clear that Dennis and those close to him had no idea about her past.
Nobody knew anything about her. I don't know her name was Linda, that was it.
When I heard about it, all I seen were visions running through my head that could have been me.
According to police, Linda's behavior remained bizarre. Her stories contradicted most of what investigators learned in their questioning. Her attorney filed for a psychiatric evaluation.
You need to be able to be aware of your charges, have a basic sense of what they are and the severity of them, and you also need to be able to work with your attorney. In order to be incompetent, you have to have some sort of mental defect or disease. The evaluation consists essentially of observing and talking to the person. They can last from 15 minutes to 2 hours, and it all depends on the seriousness of the charges and also the kind of issues that are being dealt with.
Her interview lasted 15 minutes. Linda's behavior was described as atypical for mental disorder.
He felt that she was trying to act crazy in order to not go forward with her case or to stay in the psychiatric center instead of going to the jail to await her trial. It was another tactic to avoid facing the charges.
By 2005, doctors decided Linda Pilius was competent to stand trial. In a preliminary hearing, a judge denied Linda's claim that the statement she gave to investigators was forcibly made.
I decided to plead guilty because I didn't want to take it to trial and put his family through a lot of stuff. I felt guilty for what I did to him. I felt like I deserved the time. I felt like I was a menace to society and that I don't deserve to be let out.
Because of her history, Wagner asked the court to consider the interests of society when sentencing Pilius.
I asked for the most serious sentence she could receive, which was 25 years.
My sentence is 22 years. Flat. I'll be 65 by the time I leave here, if I make it.
Killing somebody, I don't think sentence is long enough.
I think it was a joke. She assaulted others before with the intent to kill.
She's just an evil woman, and she deserves to be where she is.
When you take somebody else's life and you get 22, no, it's not enough. Not for killing somebody else, no.
Some feel Linda will succumb to her disease before she is released from prison.
22 years for this woman. It's a long time, and it might be a life sentence for her anyway.
I got a chance to apologize to his parents.
Linda recalls an unplanned meeting with Dennis's parents in the hospital immediately following the death of their son.
When I was going out to the hospital in Rochester, I was shocked that they were sitting there. And I looked at his mother and I said, please forgive me. I said, please forgive me. And she just looked and looked away.
Though he has not been a part of Linda's life for a long time, Brian still thinks about her.
I just wish her the best. I feel sorry for her. I wish that her life could have been different.
I go to church and I believe that the good Lord's gonna help me, give me strength to endure. September 7, 2004 means to me a day of hell. It took away my rights to live in society. He was a good man, and I wish I could take it back, but I can't.